Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Haiti, a street vendor tries to revive his cell phone business.
Nothing's easy anymore since the earthquake. Most people went back to their towns. Others, well, they're dead. And people that are here don't have money. So business is slow.
Water slavery in Ethiopia. Some women spend most of their day lugging 50-pound jerry cans home from the river. And savoring a spleen sandwich in Sicily.
I'm telling you in the Palermo dialect to mange.
Assa mangia.
Eat it.
Che mangia. Assa mangia.
I obey, chewing the tender meat that shames those two all-beef patties.
Mmm. Buonissimo. Complimenti. Complimenti.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Haitians are still struggling to survive following that devastating earthquake in January. There's been a lot of coverage of the most vulnerable Haitians, the children. But there's another group just as fragile who's been hard hit, the elderly. Dr. Martin Gorbian is a geriatrician with Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. He arrived in Haiti a week ago to work with an aid group called Help Age International. Dr. Gorbian, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
We've heard a lot about what Haitians are suffering and how difficult it is living out in these camps. But for the elderly, it would seem they are particularly vulnerable. Can you describe for us what the challenges and dangers are for those in Haiti who are over 65 and have been displaced?
If you're old and or weak, frail. We're, of course, meeting many people who are blind, and it really is survival of the fittest in terms of getting food and water. So we're seeing a lot of malnutrition and dehydration. You have to be able to stand in line to get food and water, and if you don't have somebody who can do that on your behalf, you perhaps won't be able to be in that line at all, let alone be at the front of the line. There are many older people in the tent cities, people who don't want to leave. It seems so hard to fathom when you see what home actually means here in Haiti, but it's certainly a very visceral response to want to stay with people who are familiar to you and in a setting that is familiar as well.
Who's taking care of these people in the tent cities?
Some people have lost all of their family and are with strangers, other people are with friends, and other people are with members of their family. But when we were at the municipal nursing home 2 days ago, we certainly saw evidence of great compassion, where individuals, younger, stronger individuals, were carrying those who could not walk. Having said that, of course, we know there's a dark side, and that dark side would be food is being stolen from older adults because they don't have the ability to protect the very few resources that they do have.
Dr. Gorbian, we've heard so many stories about just the mental and emotional toll this earthquake has had on Haitians. How do the elderly, who are obviously a lot more vulnerable, hold up emotionally under these kinds of conditions?
People are in the moment. They're dealing with the day-to-day struggles. They're in need of resources. Old folks are concerned about the things that are bothering them in terms of pain and other medical conditions. And keep in mind that we're also dealing with a lot of people who do have dementia. I once read that 13th century Roman Catholic theologians considered dementia a gift from God because therefore people didn't have to see all the terrible things that were going on in the world. And as I recall that concept, I'm thinking about perhaps the positive side of not having the ability to fully recognize what's happening right now. And in addition to that, this is a group of people whose expectations are different than ours. And this has been a group of people who have had hard lives under the best of circumstances. So that adds to their strength and it adds to their resilience.
Dr. Martin Gorbian is a geriatrician with Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Dr. Gorbian, thank you so much for joining us from Haiti.
Thank you.
It's not uncommon to see vendors in Port-au-Prince walking down the street with big, bright phones in their hands. That's the way they advertise what they're selling. Not phones, but phone calls. For a few cents a minute, people can rent the vendor's phone to make a quick call. But business for phone vendors is hurting now. Grant Fuller explains why in this installment of our Street Vendor series.
I found 62-year-old Francois Sinus on the dirt path they call Main Street in one of Port-au-Prince's biggest camps. His salt and pepper sideburns highlighted a friendly face, so I approached him.
How long have you been doing this?
As he held a bulky, bright orange phone, Sinus told me his story.
Well, I used to be a farmer, and I also used to make bricks. But then I moved to Port-au-Prince. And you know, when you get to a certain age, you can't do the same things anymore. As you can see, I'm too old for that now. That's life.
2 years ago, Sinus's kids went to a local cell phone company and bought him one of their customized vendor phones. It's the size of a desk phone, with fat buttons, an LCD screen, and even a cord. But it functions like a cell phone and uses a pay-as-you-go system. Right away, Sinus set out to make a living with it.
A person might have a phone, but sometimes the battery's dead or they don't have minutes on their account. So they see me and they use the phone.
If your call is successful, you pay a few cents for the service. If the call doesn't go through, you don't have to pay. Sinus was doing fine in general, he says, until the earthquake. One of his daughters died, and her body still hasn't been found. His house is unlivable. So now he lives in this camp, but still works the same way he did before. Or at least he tries to. The day I caught up with him, Sinus hadn't had much luck. As he made a loop around the camp and out to the street, I followed behind and listened to him on the hunt for a customer.
When you sit down, you really don't find people wanting to make calls. But when you're moving around, you might walk here and you find somebody. Walk a little bit further and you find somebody else. It's good exercise and I keep in shape. But you know, if I find some business, I find it. If I don't, I don't. Life tells you that you have to be content with what you get. After the earthquake, nothing's been working. Some people found their relatives this way by calling, but others couldn't get through because the signal was really bad. So it was just a game of luck.
No,
nope. It didn't go through. That guy was looking for something called Papadap that just lets you send minutes to someone's phone automatically. But I don't have the money yet to start a Papadap service. Nothing's easy anymore since the earthquake. Most people went back to their towns. Others, well, they're dead. And people that are here don't have money, so business is slow. I've had zero business today, nothing at all. All I can say is that even if God doesn't give you anything today, you still need to be happy.
And with that, Sinus trudges uphill on the camp's dirt path. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Music often fills the streets in Haiti, and right now, local radio stations are paying tribute to the many musicians who died in the earthquake. Jean Jimmy Alexandre was one of them. He was better known as hip-hop Creole singer Jimmy O. Here's his song, Zange Nan Ciel. Winter in Afghanistan is brutal. If you really want to get warm, the place to go is the local hammam or bathhouse. It's a popular place because most homes in Afghanistan don't have running water, let alone showers. Our reporter Will Everett looked forward to relaxing at the hammam after his long days of reporting in Kabul, but it didn't last for long. Here's Will's reporter's notebook.
It was the best idea my guide had had all day. Let's go have a shower. So we headed off to the local hammam. The word hammam means shower, but the one we visited was owned by an enterprising Afghan who ran his hammam like a health spa, offering haircuts and massages in addition to what he advertised as the hottest showers in town. Three barbers were busy cutting hair while the customers lounged around exchanging gossip. There was a long wait to get into the showers, so I decided to see what a $1 Afghan haircut would look like. I was a little nervous when I saw a child barber, a boy of about 10, going to work on another boy with electric shears. But apparently it's common for kids to cut the hair of other kids. My barber, however, was Saeed, the 30-something owner. As I was admiring my new haircut, Saeed beckoned me toward the door leading into the showers. He held out a pair of plastic sandals and a packet of Head & Shoulders shampoo and led me into a room lined with six rusting metal stalls on either side. A few fluorescent bulbs hung from a ceiling black with dripping algae. Nope, I don't mean mold. It was really algae. The only English Saeed knew was the phrase, "What else you want? What else you need?" I turned on the faucet and felt the sudden rush of hot water and thought, what else could I possibly need? The shower cost about 25 cents for 1 hour. Now and then the attendant would yell at someone whose time was up. When my time was up, I dried off and went out into the anteroom where someone handed me a glass of tea. Saeed gestured toward a mat on the floor, where lunch was being prepared for the employees. I sat down with them, and the Afghans seemed to glow with appreciation. Most of the time, the only foreigners they see are zooming past in armored cars, and they seemed to enjoy being able to see one at close range, an exotic animal that had wandered out of its cage. Soon I was coming back every other day. Saeed had found his first foreign customer, and he was anxious to please. Suddenly there was a selection of shampoo packets to choose from. The algae was scrubbed off the ceiling, and the dusty waiting room was given a good scrubbing as well. Saeed knew a good business opportunity when he saw one. Here was one happy American customer, so surely there would be more. But his Afghan patrons were nervous. If Saeed was upgrading the hammam, would he also raise his prices? According to my translator, most of Saeed's customers made only $2 or $3 a day, so even an increase of a dime was substantial. I felt a slight chill creeping into their former friendliness. I didn't go back. I returned to the pathetic drizzle of the guest house shower, leaving the hammam to its Afghan clientele. Nothing was more difficult on a freezing day than passing by those steamy windows and not going in. I wondered if Saeed was looking for me, wondering what had happened to his American dream.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter and producer based in Texas. In some parts of the world, the idea of a shower or any kind of running water isn't even imaginable. More on that ahead. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Congress passed a health care reform bill last week. The new law will cover millions of uninsured Americans, and it will add many more low-income people to the Medicaid rolls. But it won't change the unique health care plan that a group of street musicians have grown accustomed to. Lisa Morehouse has this story on the New Orleans Musicians Clinic.
Walk into St. Anna's Episcopal Church and you can attend Mass and then share a fellowship meal, both with great musical accompaniment. And you can also see folks getting acupuncture or having their blood pressure checked.
Do you have any other medical problems? Diabetes or?
No diabetes, just high blood pressure.
This health clinic is being held in a hallway near the church's kitchen. It's run by the New Orleans Musicians Clinic and its many partners. At this weekly event, musicians get a paying gig, a free meal, and some medical attention.
Why don't you extend your arm here, and we'll just take your pressure quick. Feel a little bit of a squeeze.
The New Orleans Musicians Clinic is the brainchild of a group of doctors and musicians advocates who were astonished at the poor health and premature death rates of New Orleans musicians. Bethany Boltman was one of them.
People will go to the gig and say, oh my God, aren't we lucky so-and-so lives in New Orleans, but yet at the end of the gig, he takes the bus home and makes $12 at the gig, and then is terribly sick, and there's no money for his health care. So we started the clinic in 1998 with the idea that we would get them almost like gold card service into every one of the departments of the School of Medicine.
That's the Louisiana State University School of Medicine. For $10, clients get appointments with the full-time nurse practitioner or volunteer physicians and can also meet with specialists there and at other hospitals in town. Patients are seen at the organization's main office, as well as satellite clinics at the church. Boltman says the organization serves about 1,000 musicians and their families. She recalls one client, a famous piano player, who taught in public schools. He lost his day job and his health insurance after Katrina hit. That's when the clinic stepped in.
He's gotten two knee replacements, a hip replacement, and a heart valve operation for free. But in the old days, and I mean old days like 1995, had that happened, he would go home and he'd die a slow death and he wouldn't be performing today. And his son, who's a very well-known musician, probably wouldn't be performing either because he'd be home holding his daddy's hand and watching him die. And that's what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to keep the culture and the individuals alive.
We'd like you to know we're David and Rosalind. We've been doing a couple of interviews.
David Leonard and Rosalind Lionheart are two longtime clients at the clinic. They've been street musicians in the French Quarter for 33 years. On this day, they're sitting amidst guitars, mandolins, harmonicas, trumpets, and amps, with a guitar case opened to gather bills.
The music is guaranteed, the money is iffy.
David Leonard says he uses the musician's clinic for eye care.
I'm taking eye medicine right now. Otherwise, I could go blind. I don't want to do that. I like colors. And I like seeing pretty ladies.
Rosalind Lionheart says New Orleans ought to take better care of its musicians.
And I'm glad that the musician's clinic does.
I'm going to sit right down, write myself a letter.
New Orleans Musicians Clinic, can I help you?
At the clinic's main offices, walls are covered with photographs of brass bands, Mardi Gras Indians, and singers. Physician Kirsta Kurtz-Burke has been volunteering here for 5 years. One young tuba player she helped injured his back so badly carrying his instrument and equipment that he worried he wouldn't be able to march in Mardi Gras parades.
It was right before Mardi Gras season, and so he said, I have a parade that I have to be in every night, and that's how I make my income. And so you have to get me to the point where I can walk 8 miles, carry a 60-pound tuba, and he was able to do it.
With physical therapy and medications, the tuba player was back on his feet. Kurtzberg says musicians appreciate both the clinic's services and the fact that the staff really love music, often thanking them with CDs and tickets to shows.
But we are always like, thank you so much. I mean, just think of all the joy that that these people have brought us in the city, and also joy to the whole country. I mean, this is really special. This is unique. This is something that we've given the world is American music from New Orleans. And I don't know, it's just our little way of saying thank you for that and for really treasuring our musicians and our artists.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in New Orleans.
March 22nd was World Water Day, and that's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. Clean water for a healthy world. That's the theme of this year's World Water Week. Almost a billion people in the world don't have access to safe, clean water.
Inadequate access to water supply, sanitation, and hygiene cause the deaths of more than 1.5 million children each year.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking to the National Geographic Society on World Water Day. Events highlighting the water crisis are going on all week around the world. There's a Hydro Rhythm rock concert in Kochi, India, a kayaking tour in Brazil, and a water puppet show in Cairo. Across the U.S., UNICEF is asking restaurant patrons to pay a dollar for each glass of tap water they usually drink for free. The proceeds will go to building wells and safe water sources for children in the developing world. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. The average American uses 100 gallons of water every day. Alito Benayo uses 2.5. Alito lives in a tiny village in Ethiopia where water is dirty and scarce. Journalist Tina Rosenberg met Alito when she went to Ethiopia to cover the water crisis for National Geographic magazine. Well, Tina, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
What is that region of Ethiopia like, and why did you choose this for your story on water?
It's in the south of Ethiopia, and it's very dry. People there live probably pretty much like their ancestors lived thousands of years ago. We drove around this particular area for about a week, and I think we probably ran into 5 other vehicles in total. We chose that region because it was really the classic face of a problem that we had called water slavery, and that occurs when women have to spend most of their day, for example, 10, 11, 12 hours a day, going back and forth to a river to haul water for their family's use.
Your story focuses on one central character. Can you tell us a little bit about her? Who is she and what role does water play in her life?
Her name is Alito Benayo, and she is a woman in her mid-20s. She has 3 children. She lives in a village called Foro, which is on the top of a mountain. She's unusual only in that she had some schooling. Most of the women I met in this region, which is also very backwards in terms of women's education, most of the women I met don't even know how old they are. Alito did know and had some schooling, but dropped out early, in part because she had to help her mother haul water. I would say that for her, water plays a central issue in her life. She spends most of her day hauling water. She will do an average day at least 3 trips down the mountain, which takes about 50 minutes, and then she has to spend about half an hour a day standing in line to find a good puddle to scoop water into her jerry can from the river and then haul it back up the mountain. And so the total trip can take 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes she goes in the middle of the night because there's less traffic. It's probably the single thing she spends most of her time on, and it means, of course, she also has to leave her 3 children alone. Her 4-year-old son is in charge of his younger brothers while she's away getting water. It also means she has less time for all the other things she has to do, like cook, clean the compound, take care of the animals.
What's her husband doing while she's gathering water? What do the men do in the village?
Well, that's a good question. Much of the time they're farming. In this part of the world, the division of labor is that farming is generally men's work and women take care of everything else. But farming also has a lot of downtime. And when I visited, at about 10:30 in the morning, there were about 60 men, almost all the men in the village, who were gathered in what would be known as the village bar. I mean, it was a place that had a tin roof, and they were sitting around and drinking and talking. And what they were drinking was a homebrew made by their wives. So for many of these women, one of their trips to the river is to gather enough water to make beer, essentially, for their husbands.
Does anybody have a problem with this? Do the women complain, or do any of the men try to help the women, or is this just something that's accepted?
It's accepted. It would never occur to a man to help a woman with water. I mean, you're allowed to help your wife with water only right after she's given birth. And then there's about a 2-week period where the men go down to the river and get the water. Aside from that, men never go. And once a little boy hits the age of about 7 or 8, he also stops going. And this rule is never questioned. And it's enforced also by the women. I mean, I repeatedly asked the women I met about this. And Alito, for one, told me, if I let my husband go get water, it would reflect badly on my reputation. People would look at me and say, she's lazy.
Tina, I understand that you actually went with Alito to gather water one day. Can you tell us a little bit about that day and what it was like?
Well, I had spent so much time with her in the morning that she was getting a little upset. So I said, look, let me help you by gathering water. I'll do one trip for you. So I said, when you go in the afternoon, I'll take a jerry can for you and fill it. And that way you won't have to make that extra trip up the mountain. And so she said, that's great. She gave me a jerry can. And these are yellow plastic cans. This happened to be a 20-liter can. And they have a top, and you hold them on your back with rope or with or leather straps. So I walked down the mountain with the empty jerry can, and it was so crowded that she couldn't go to her usual spot where she draws water from, and we walked about 10 minutes further upstream to a pool of water that was less populated. We still had to wait about 40 minutes, and part of the problem is that it's not only people who are getting their water from that part of the river, it's also animals. So a lot of the puddles that people were scooping water out of were puddles that donkeys had just stepped into. And there was animal excrement all over the place. It was not a place where you would really feel comfortable drinking, and yet this is what they drank every day. So she scooped a jerry can of water for me and gave me the smooth leather straps, which I greatly appreciated. She used the rough rope for herself and tied it onto my back. And I was fine about halfway up the mountain, and then it just became too much. I thought I was in pretty good shape, but I could not carry that 20-liter jerry can, which weighs about 50 pounds, in fact, it weighs exactly 50 pounds, up the mountain. And I traded with a young girl of about 8 years, she was about 8 years old, and she was carrying a half-sized jerry can, 10 liters, so we switched. And she did okay with mine for a while, and then she didn't. So Ailito then looked at both of us with disgust, put both jerry cans on her back, and continued with 100 pounds of water on her back up the steepest part of the mountain, which was so steep, you have to use your hands to climb as well as walking.
You mentioned that an 8-year-old girl had to end up carrying your jerry can. How old are these girls when they start dragging, hauling water?
4, 5, 6, depending. I mean, they don't carry 20-liter cans at that age, but they help.
Really? 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah.
What does this actually mean for Ailito's life and the lives of the other women in that area?
Well, the big impact, I think, is that it means they don't go to school. Most of the women I met did not go to school because they had to either help their mom by fetching water or take care of their younger siblings while their mother went to fetch water.
Why is it like this? Why don't they have access to water any closer to their village?
Well, villages in most countries like this are built on the tops of mountains, in part because strategically you can see your enemy coming better, and in part because there's less malaria the higher up you get.
Now, you mentioned that when you went down to the river to get the water, there were donkeys in there and excrement. I mean, I can't imagine what the quality of this water is. How do they purify it first, or are they really drinking this filthy water?
They're sick all the time. They're sick. They're constantly, the little money they have from selling their crops goes to $5 and $10 medical visits to the health clinic to be cured of Giardia and other parasites. And when I visited Foro, the area was in the middle of an extremely serious outbreak of waterborne disease. There were tents set up to manage this, and people were dying of it.
Is the government or any charitable group fighting to change this for people in places like this?
Yes, there's a lot going on. And one of the reasons we chose this area was that there are some very interesting and hopeful projects going on in that area. And as a matter of fact, it's very possible that in the next few months, Ailito Binayo is going for the first time in her life, the first time in anybody's lives in the memory of this village, is going to have a tap with water in the village, just a couple of steps from her front door, and her life will change immeasurably in so many ways.
Well, that would be revolutionary for her.
It would be. It truly would be. In Ethiopia, water is the job of each district. It's not a national government job. And so the districts vary greatly in their abilities to do this and in the amount of money they have to spend on it. And in Kanso, which was the place where we went, there are villages where the government has just never been able to do anything. And either they've never tried because the geography is just too daunting, or they have tried and they've dug wells, but those wells have failed. So we went in with a group called WaterAid, which is a non-governmental organization that's based in Britain. And basically the government in that area has turned over water management in the hardest to serve villages over to WaterAid. And what they're planning to do in Ailito Binayo's village is this. They've dug a well at the bottom of a ravine several miles away. It's a strong stream, so what they can do is put in a motorized pump and they're going to lay pipes to the top of a mountain, and the motor will push the water up the top of the mountain. And then gravity will take that water through pipes down the other side of the mountain to serve various villages. And Foro, Ailito's village, is going to be one of those that's going to be getting water.
Did you talk to her about this new development and what it will mean for her life and her children?
Yeah. Well, it's hard for her to believe, in part because she's never seen it, and in part because most people don't believe promises that you hear about things like that, because there tend to be a lot of promises and they don't work out. But it's going to have a huge impact on her life. I mean, her ambitions are heartbreakingly simple. Lately, things have been getting worse in their life, in part because of the water shortage. And it's gotten a lot worse because of the areas growing hotter and drier with climate change. But because of the water shortage, they have this tremendous new outbreak of waterborne disease, and their crops are failing. So what she wants out of life is really just to sort of get back to where she was before. But when she does think about what water in the village would bring to her, what she thinks of it is in terms of how much time it would free up to do her other chores, to do more cooking, to keep the compound cleaner, to, you know, feed the animals better. She never mentions free time. She never mentions spending time with her children.
Speaking of the children, I assume this will mean some of the young girls can go to school, or will they be enlisted in household chores instead?
No, I think that that will help young girls go to school. There is also a push to get girls in school. The government is doing something very smart, which is they have a lot of donated food. And so what they do is they give these bags of grain and cans of cooking oil to students, especially girl students. If they complete a semester of school, then their family gets this food, which is great because it gives a family a very strong incentive to keep their girls in school. But I think if moms don't have to spend 8, 9, 10 hours a day away from their families gathering water, I think that will allow them to send their girls to school.
Well, Tina Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Tina Rosenberg's article is called The Burden of Thirst. It's part of National Geographic's special edition on water, on the stands right now. There's much more ahead. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. In Sicily's capital, Palermo, fast food is available on nearly every corner, but you won't find a golden arch in sight. Sicilians are eating their own versions of fast food, chickpea fritters, fried rice balls, even spleen sandwiches. The food's affordable, and that's important because 1 in 3 Sicilians lives below the poverty line. Reporter Nancy Greenlees hit the streets of Palermo to find the perfect spleen sandwich.
Drivers tear around Palermo's port, passing boats with white masts poking into the sky. The deep blue sea may offer a bountiful feast, but the drivers screech to a halt at Pane Camiausa. That's the name of the tiny joint and also the type of sandwich this family-run business has sold for nearly 7 decades. Gaetano Favata stands behind the counter, stirring a silver vat filled with the organ meat.
Are you going to eat one?
If you like Palermo, you have to eat a spleen sandwich.
Well, this certainly isn't spaghetti or pizza, yet Sicilians are believed to have eaten this organ sandwich since the Middle Ages. Favata has worked here since he was 15 and knows his beloved sandwich has been around much longer than his 52 years.
For centuries, since this is a dish that originated with the Jews, truly with the Jews.
Or so many say, but it's not well documented. In Palermo, many Jews worked as butchers. Some think they invented the inexpensive sandwich.
This is how spleen sandwiches started, and as the years have passed, they've evolved into these exquisite snacks. But way back when, people ate the sandwich to stave off hunger. The rich were not eating these sandwiches.
The wealthy got the best cuts of meat, and most other Sicilians made do with the rest. Spleen sandwiches are still considered pretty cheap, but these days everyone eats them. To make one, the cow's spleen is cleaned, boiled, and cooled. The organ ends up looking like a lean steak. This is where Favata's work begins.
Cut little slices of the spleen, 3 slices.
You put them in the pan. You cook them slowly over a low flame. See the lard in the vat? We let the slices heat up for just a few minutes.
Favata grabs a crusty round roll that's soft inside to better absorb the juices. With the other hand, he dips a flat ladle into the vat and pulls up a pile of fried spleen that he delicately places on the open roll. You'd think he was doling out caviar instead of a Sicilian sloppy joe.
We put a little salt on it, a squirt of lemon. We put paper around it, add a napkin, and give it to the customer, and you can eat it. Eat it. I'm telling you in the Palermo dialect to mangia.
Assa mangia, in palermitano.
Eat it.
Cioè, mangia, assa mangia.
I obey, chewing the tender meat that shames those two all-beef patties.
Mmm. It's very, very good.
The meat is a little bit salty. Obviously fresh and well-chosen meat.
Buonissimo. Complimenti, complimenti.
Some top the sandwich with ricotta, or the local caciocavallo cheese. Favata is convinced spleen sandwiches are healthy. He points to an article framed on the restaurant's tiled wall that backs him up. Granted, cooking a spleen in lard boosts the cholesterol level, but at $2.30, at least the price won't give you a heart attack. Another customer double parks and dashes in to pick up a few sandwiches.
E via!
You see? And he's off. It's fast food that's very fast. You order it, eat it, hop in the car, and take off. You're in and out, in and out. That's why it's wonderful, truly fantastic.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Palermo.
You can see how the spleen sandwiches are made. There's a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Eugene Cho describes himself as a regular guy, a middle-class father of three who loves his electronic gadgets and social networking sites. A few years ago, Eugene Cho took a trip to Burma. While he was there, he met people who were getting by on almost nothing, and that made Eugene take another look at his family's life. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
What was it you saw in Burma that made such a big impact on you?
I think prior to the trip, like many folks, I've learned a lot, read a lot about human trafficking, genocide, extreme poverty. But I think there is a great distinction when you read things and you process it as data, and then you go and see for yourselves, and you see fathers, mothers, children, siblings who are going through some great duress, incredible suffering.
So you decide you wanted to do something about this. What did you think you could actually do as an individual?
For my wife and I, we have three children. We personally wanted to do something. And so after some wrestling and thoughts and prayer, we don't share this to sound altruistic in any way, but we felt convicted to give up a year's salary. And so that's $68,000 for me as a minister. And it was difficult to do, especially in hindsight with how difficult the economic situation was the past couple of years. But in addition to giving a year's wages, we really wanted to see if we could inspire people around the world by not just sharing our story, but sharing the stories of brave and courageous, hopeful women, men, children around the world doing amazing things to fight poverty.
You came back to Seattle and you decided what you would do is give up an entire year's wages? I mean, who can do that?
Well, it wasn't easy. In fact, it was very difficult. I'd be lying to you if I said it was an easy decision. We don't have $68,000 in cash lying around. And so we needed to kind of make plans to make that decision come to pass, come to fruition. So it took about 2 years to make plans to do so.
How did you do without your salary for a year, a salary of $68,000 with three kids to support? I mean, what kind of sacrifices did you have to make to do that?
You know, I always feel awkward sharing these things because, you know, our desire isn't to bring attention to ourselves. But, you know, we're blessed. And so we have a home that we share with our parents. And we also have a rental home that we have in Seattle. And so the grand master plan was that we would sell our rental home and pay off some debts and donate $68,000. We would sell some other stuff and we would come out looking like altruistic people. The reason why it was so difficult was that this thing called the global economy crisis took place. The housing market bubbled and crashed. And so we were unable to sell that home. And so what ended up happening was that we had to really be creative, reducing some of the ballet lessons for our kids. I had to sell some of the toys that I like, some gadgets that I have. I worked a little extra time to be able to make some money as a speaker, writing as well. We had to move our family out of our home for about 7 weeks to make some money subletting our home. That was extremely difficult, but we made this pledge. It was very important for us to honor that pledge and to be good with donating a year's wages. And those are some of the small practical things that we had to do.
And how involved are your children in this, Eugene?
Well, this was a family decision for sure. You know, we explained this to them. One of the reasons why this also got started was probably about 2 years ago. On Friday nights, we have a family night. And so all of our kids, three kids, we sit down and watch a movie together. And so we're watching cable TV on a Friday night. And we flip through this cable TV station, and it aired one of those infomercials of children that are starving around the world. We normally just kind of flip through that channel as fast as possible. And for some reason that night, I chose to keep it on that station. And I still recall how their faces changed, almost was distorting in some way as they saw these images. And I still vividly remember the two questions that my oldest daughter asked me. The first question was, is this a movie? Because I think she was so shocked that this could even be remotely real, and trying to explain to her, no, this isn't a movie, this is real. And then her second question was very provoking, haunting and challenging. What are we doing to help? And again, that was an example of numerous things that took place, including our trip to Burma, that kind of inspired us to say, we really want to do something. We need to do something.
Did you send the money to the people in Burma that you had met, or did you send it somewhere else?
Yeah. So what we did is that we started this organization called One Day's Wages, where we're asking people around the world to simply consider donating one day's wages, which is about 0.4% of one's annual salary. And so our year donation went to this fund. And so we're collecting all of these donations, and this will go to help partner with organizations along with specific projects around the world. There's three partnerships that we're involved in right now. One is in Congo, where we're providing 250 fresh start kits for women of Eastern Congo who've been victims of war and gender violence. And in Ethiopia, we're raising $25,000 to build one water well and to provide clean sanitation system for one entire primary school. The last one that we're doing happens to be in Nepal, India, where we're building a border outpost or border crossing to help rescue about 300 young Nepalese girls from human trafficking. But when a person comes to our website, there's a calculator. They can plug in their salary, calculate their day's wages, and they can choose exactly where they want to invest their day's wages.
What kind of feedback and participation have you gotten?
It's been great.
Has anyone actually donated a day's wages?
Oh, absolutely. It comes in every day. I don't know the exact amount, but in less than 3 months, and this includes our donation, we have $144,000 that have been raised. So the compelling thing about what we're doing is that we're trying to remind people, because it's so easy, I think, to abdicate our responsibility to rock stars and millionaires and Hollywood A-list people. And our movement is trying to compel and convince people that every voice matters, that everyone needs to care about these issues.
Eugene Cho, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Eugene Cho is founder of OneDaysWages.org. He spoke to us from Seattle.
The distance between us is not as big as it seems.
That's the musical group Talia's Whisper. The women sing about forgiveness. They'll be performing next week at a conference in New York City put on by their parent organization, Femininza. Femininza trains women in conflict resolution. Reporter Judy Martin was there when Talia's Whisper was rehearsing.
Because we believe in the brightness of living.
About two dozen women are gathered at a retreat center in upstate New York. They sit in a tight-knit circle, holding lyric sheets in front of them as they learn a song.
We know every life needs a chance to be the best that they can be.
The women are from a number of countries, including Great Britain, Germany, Australia, and the United States. all are members of Feminanza, an international organization focusing on women's issues such as self-esteem, health, and education. The organization also trains women in places like Rwanda and Kenya to be reconciliation and forgiveness counselors. Mary Noble is the CEO and co-founder of Feminanza. She says a couple of years ago, a few of her volunteers came to her with the idea to put their mission to music.
We have a number of really talented singers, songwriters in Feminanza who are saying, look, is there some way that we can use our skills to help support the work of Feminanza in the world and specifically to get the message of forgiveness across and fundraise at the same time? And out of that, the idea of a choir was born.
They called it Talia's Whisper. Talia is the name of the Greek muse of song, beauty, and creativity. And why whisper?
It's the whisper of something that is like a message that can be passed from woman to woman across the world, saying something is stirring, something is changing, something new is happening.
The group has performed a series of concerts in London and has also recorded a CD. Proceeds from its sale go to support Feminanza's programs.
And this particular song, Thank You For Today, carries that essence of hope, which we hope that in the singing of it, it literally transfers that feeling of hope to everybody who hears it.
Seconds turned hours. Ones never want to be alone.
Well, my name is Anne Elisha, and I'm from Denmark. To me, music is like it's like a sanctuary where I can find the best of myself inside of that. And to me, Talia's Whisper is providing more of that sanctuary.
Thank you for the starlight that guides our way.
Like the harmonies. I don't know, that's just, it just really worked. That was really good. A very short story I wanted to tell you from when we were in Nakuru. We spent 2 days working with these 25 women. We said, how's it been for you? And they said, to just be sitting here, having this kind of conversation as people is for us already an extraordinary thing. So we said, what do you mean, as people? And they said, well, from some of the communities that we come from, a woman is not considered a person.
Jungles and the
Talia's Whisper now has more than 40 members from about 6 countries. But at a performance in London last year, Mary Noble says it was the diversity in the audience that created a moving experience.
People in the audience were a combination of people working in the field of conflict resolutions. So we had a young group of English-born women, Muslims, who have their own choir. We had, you know, Israelis there, profoundly moved. I mean, the feedback was quite extraordinary.
Give a girl a chance. She's got the future within her. Give a girl a chance.
The hope is that within the next year, the choir will perform for the women Feminanza works with in developing countries. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judy Martin in New York.
Each other's stories and dreams. The distance between us is not as big as it seems. We're finding new ways to grow the brightness of living. Chance and let the whole world win. it's divine to us.
And that's our show for today. You can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can tweet us, and you can find us on Facebook. Details on how to do all of that are on the web. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer, and Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization. Yeah.